Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for March 13th. I'm your volunteer reader, Jack Palmer. In this hour, we'll be reading headlines, Valley and State, and USA Today headlines. Our first article is entitled, Privatizing Public Land, a Fear with Doge Cuts. Some who tend to the nation's federal lands are worried about what President Donald Trump and billionaire Elon Musk's layoffs may do to national parks, summer tourism, and even the battle against wildfires this spring. They're even more concerned about what might come next. It's entirely predictable that if you dismantle systems for responsibility managing public lands, causing a collapse in responsible land management, a case can and will be made to privatize those lands, said Ethan Almack, the executive director of the Grand Canyon Trust, which would be catastrophic. Across the West, nonprofits, advocates, and philanthropy groups that support public lands and the people who maintain them are warning that diminished operations at organizations including the U.S. Forest Service, the National Park Service, and the Bureau of Land Management could fuel calls to privatize the nation's public lands. Their worries come as Trump makes dramatic cuts to the federal workforce with the help of Musk, the world's richest man and the leader of the Department of Government Efficiency. When I look beyond the veil, what I'm seeing is an attempt to make federal land management agency jobs even harder still, getting rid of people, and then being able to show that the agency is unable to care for these lands, and it would be better in the hands of private interests, said Matthew Nelson, the executive director of the Arizona Scenic Trail Association. The federal government owns more than 640 million acres of public land in the United States, including more than a third of land in Arizona. Much of the nation's federal land is located in the West and in Alaska. Federal land in Arizona is managed primarily by agencies within the Department of Agriculture and the Department of the Interior, according to the Congressional Research Service. Both departments have seen their staff counts trimmed in the first months of the Trump era. The Forest Service, a part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, manages millions of acres of national forests and grasslands across the country. It fired 10% of its workforce last month. The cut amounted to roughly 3,400 probationary employees, a group of people who have typically worked for the government for fewer than 1 or 2 years and are easier to terminate. Meanwhile, another 800 people have been fired from the Bureau of Land Management, overseen by the Interior Department. Plus, some 1,000 National Park Service employees were terminated on Valentine's Day. Some cuts may not be permanent. The USDA has been ordered by a federal personnel board to restore probationary employees who were fired after mid-February. If you were trying to destroy an agency's ability to function and you purposely were wanting to make them fail, this is what you would do. You would create these kinds of hardships, said Bobby Scopa, a board member of the Grassroots Wildland Firefighters Advocacy Group. Then you can blame the agency for not doing a good job. The federal hiring freeze has left some seasonal firefighters fearful that they won't begin their jobs on time ahead of Arizona's wildfire season, although the White House said that firefighters are not a target of the DOGE cuts. Federal employees who are still working for the government have gone quiet in some cases. That's according to organizations that communicate often with the federal employees who manage public lands. They have struggled to get responses on projects and funding from federal partners who they suspect are afraid to step out of line and risk losing their jobs. "We're getting ghosted," Nelson said. "Since the firing has started, nobody is responding to anything." Nelson said the Arizona Scenic Trail Association often works with federal employees at the Forest Service to care for the Arizona Scenic Trail. The trail runs for 800 miles across Arizona from Mexico to Utah. AUMAC, who leads the Grand Canyon Trust, agreed that federal employees have gone quiet. "Many are scared for their jobs and their livelihoods," he said. "A lot of folks are waiting for the next shoe to drop," AUMAC said. "There's a tremendous amount of uncertainty and angst. Morale is very low." The Pacific Crest Trail Association has been met with similar science, said Justin Kuhman, director of trail operations. His organization advocates for the Pacific Crest Trail, a 2,650-mile trail that runs from Mexico to Canada through California, Oregon, and Washington. "The ones who are still around truly are doing the best they can, but they are dealing with a lot of uncertainty, and that's resulting in a lot of caution with how and what they communicate," Kuhman said. The association has pared down its hiring in response to DOGE and canceled 56 weeks of trail crew projects. "With so much uncertainty as to whether or not that money is going to flow, we do not want to commit to spending it before we know it's actually going to be there," Kuhman said. The PCTA receives a little over $600,000 per year from the Forest Service, and without knowing if that money will flow, this is where we have to pump the brakes. Voters in the West support public land management policies, according to a poll conducted by Colorado College shortly before Inauguration Day. The research was conducted jointly by a Democratic polling firm and a GOP polling firm. 84% of Arizonans approve of the job the National Park Service is doing, and 76% have a positive approval of the Forest Service, according to the poll. The numbers are smaller across the West. "There's nothing in this data that would indicate that people are upset with how these agencies are operating or that they feel that reducing funding is a good idea," said Newbridge strategy pollster Lori Weigel, a Colorado Republican who worked on the survey. Conservation in the West surveyed 3,316 registered voters across 8 Western states: Arizona, Colorado, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming, from January 3rd to 17th. The margin of error was ±2.46%. For its part, the Trump administration has left the door open to privatizing federal lands. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum has referred to the nation's public lands as America's balance sheet. In his role, the North Dakota Republican and former governor oversees millions of acres of federal land. "We have all this debt," Burgum said in January. "We never talk about the assets." Trump ordered the largest reversal of land monument protections in American history in 2017, when he signed an order to reduce Bears Ears National Monument in Utah by 85% and cut the Grand Staircase Escalante in half. Former President Joe Biden restored the protections in 2021. U.S. Senator Martin Heinrich, Democrat of New Mexico, raised the alarm about privatizing federal land last week. Roughly a third of his state's land is owned by the federal government. "Laying off the people who care for these lands is step one," Heinrich said at a virtual roundtable with other lawmakers and terminated public lands employees. They want to be able to say that our public lands are going unmanaged. The White House did not respond to Tuesday for a request for comment. In the weeks since Trump trimmed the federal workforce, longer lines have been reported at the Grand Canyon, a major tourism hub for the state. Things could get worse in the spring and summer, Almack said. It could be grim. We're talking endless lines to get into Grand Canyon National Park, overflowing trash and unmaintained roads. Nelson agreed, saying, all the things that we kind of take for granted when we go out hiking or visiting public lands, like trail conditions and bathrooms, will start to decline with fewer staff. My fear is that this is an attempt to say, listen, these agencies don't do their jobs very well. These lands should be privatized, Nelson said. If those lands become compromised or if they become privatized, then we will be living in a very different state where access to these areas might only be for those who have the resources to enjoy them, which is extremely un-American. The next article is entitled, Massive Storm Hits California Before Heading Eastward, written by Christopher Kahn. California braced for the arrival of a major specific storm on Wednesday, enacting road closures and issuing evacuation warnings in parts of Los Angeles and Malibu vulnerable to mudslides and debris flows. The potent storm, which will put nearly the entire central U.S. at risk of dangerous weather later this week, will dump several feet of snow along the Sierra Nevada mountains and bring torrential rain to San Francisco, Los Angeles, and San Diego. A smaller storm system moved over the state on Tuesday. The incoming rain could fall at rates of an inch per hour, raising the risk of flooding, mudslides, and debris flows, especially in areas charred by the wildfires that engulfed whole neighborhoods earlier this year. The Los Angeles Fire Department issued evacuation warnings and orders for residents in the areas torched by the Palisades, Sunset, and Hearst wildfires. More than two dozen neighborhoods in Malibu were also placed under evacuation warnings. Residents should prepare to evacuate now due to the significant risk of flash flooding, debris flows, and mudslides, the city's Office of Public Safety said in a statement on social media. These hazards pose a serious threat to life and property. In addition to the evacuation advisories, officials shut down several major roads, including a section of the Pacific Coast Highway in Malibu. The Los Angeles County Department of Health also issued an advisory telling beachgoers to stay out of the water due to potentially higher bacteria levels. The county said heavy rain from the incoming storm could carry bacteria, chemicals, debris, and other hazards into public waterways. The ocean water quality advisory will be in effect until at least 4 p.m. Friday, the agency said. The National Weather Service anticipates between 1 foot to 3 feet of snow piling up across the Sierra Nevada mountains this week, raising the risk of avalanches and making travel at high elevations dangerous. Heavy snow and powerful wind gusts of 40 miles to 70 miles per hour below many major passes will create dangerous to potentially impossible travel conditions across the Sierra Nevada and Northern California higher terrain this afternoon into Thursday, the National Weather Service said. AccuWeather warned blizzard conditions were possible in the Sierra Nevada due to the high winds. The storm heading east this week may bring blizzard conditions to the high plains. A low-pressure system moved over the southern plains on Wednesday and brought the possibility of severe thunderstorms, large hail, and wind damage today for Northeast Texas, Oklahoma, Western Arkansas, and Louisiana, the Weather Service said. These storms are only a preview of the major impacts forecast for the central U.S. on Friday and into the weekend when the storm makes its way across the country. The colossal storm will put more than 100 million people at risk of severe weather, from blizzard conditions in the northern plains to tornadoes and wildfires in the south. The next article is entitled, Trump Threatens More Tariffs, written by David Lauder and Andrea Shalal and Jarrett Renshaw. President Donald Trump threatened on Wednesday to escalate a global trade war with further tariffs on European Union goods, as major U.S. trading partners said they would retaliate for trade barriers already erected. Just hours after Trump's 25% duties on all U.S. steel and aluminum imports took effect, Trump said he would impose additional penalties if the EU follows through with its plans to enact counter-tariffs on some U.S. goods next month. "Whatever they charge us, we're charging them," Trump told reporters at the White House. Trump's hyper-focus on tariffs has rattled investor, consumer, and business confidence and raised recession fears. He has also frayed relations with Canada, a close ally and major trading partner, by repeatedly threatening to annex the neighboring country. Canada, the biggest foreign supplier of steel and aluminum to the United States, announced 25% retaliatory tariffs on those metals, along with computers, sports equipment, and other products worth $20 billion in total. Canada has already imposed tariffs worth a similar amount on U.S. goods in response to broader tariffs by Trump. "We will not stand idly by while our iconic steel and aluminum industries are being unfairly targeted," Canada's Finance Minister Dominique LeBlanc said. Canada's central bank also cut interest rates to prepare the country's economy for disruption. Trump's action to bulk up protections for U.S. steel and aluminum producers restores effective tariffs of 25% on all imports of the metals and extends the duties to hundreds of downstream products, from nuts and bolts to bulldozer blades and soda cans. U.S. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick said Trump would impose trade protections on copper as well. A Reuters Ipsos poll found 57% of Americans think Trump is being too erratic in his effort to shake up the U.S. economy, and 70% expect that the tariffs will make regular purchases more expensive. The 27 countries of the European Union are less exposed, as only a small fraction of targeted products are exported to the United States, according to Germany's Kiel Institute. The EU's countermeasures, due to take effect next month, would target up to $28 billion worth of U.S. goods like dental floss, diamonds, bathrobes, and bourbon, which likewise account for a small portion of the giant EU-U.S. commercial relationship. Still, the liquor industry warned they would be devastating on its sector. Nevertheless, Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said the bloc would resume talks with U.S. officials. "It is not in our common interest to burden our economies with such tariffs," she said. At the White House, Trump said he would, of course, respond with further tariffs if the EU followed through on its plan. With Irish Prime Minister Michael Martin at his side, Trump criticized the EU member country for luring away U.S. pharmaceutical companies. In remarks delivered later at a White House ceremony, Martin touted the history of free trade between the two nations. "Let us continue to build on that foundation," he said. "Let us continue to work together to make sure that we maintain that mutually beneficial two-way economic relationship that has allowed innovation and creativity and prosperity to thrive." China's foreign ministry said Beijing would safeguard its interests, while Japan's chief cabinet secretary, Yoshimasa Hayashi, said the move could have a major impact on U.S.-Japan economic ties. Close U.S. allies Britain and Australia criticized the blanket tariffs, but ruled out immediate tit-for-tat duties. Brazil, the number two provider of steel to the United States, said it would not immediately retaliate. With Wednesday's tariff increase well flagged in advance, global stocks were barely changed on Wednesday. But the back and forth on tariffs has left companies unnerved, and producers of luxury cars and chemicals painted a gloomy picture of consumer and industrial health. More than 900 of the 1,500 largest U.S. companies have mentioned tariffs on earnings calls or at investor events this year, according to LSEG data. "We're in a trade war, and when a trade war begins, it tends to sustain itself and feed itself," Airbus CEO Guillaume Faury said on French television. U.S. steel producers welcomed Wednesday's move, noting Trump's 2018 tariffs had been weakened by numerous exceptions. The cost of aluminum and steel in the United States hovered near record peaks. J.P. Morgan's chief economist forecast a 40% chance of a U.S. recession this year and lasting damage to the country's standing as a reliable investment destination if Trump undermines trust in U.S. governance. A steep U.S. stock sell-off in March has wiped out all of the gains notched by Wall Street following Trump's election. The escalation of the U.S.-Canada trade war occurred as Prime Minister Justin Trudeau prepares to hand over power to his successor, Mike Carney, who won the leadership race of the ruling Liberals last weekend. "I'm ready to sit down with President Trump at the appropriate time, under a position where there's respect for Canadian sovereignty, and we're working for a common approach," Carney said while touring a steel plant in Ontario. Other Canadian officials are due to meet with U.S. officials in Washington on Thursday. Travelers are steering clear of the United States, with bookings down 20% from a year ago. Canadian Energy Minister Jonathan Wilkinson told Reuters that Canada could impose non-tariff measures, such as restricting oil exports to the United States. The next article is entitled, "Russia Waives Ukraine Ceasefire," written by Guy Falconbridge and Dmitry Antonov. The Kremlin said on Wednesday it would review details from Washington about a proposal for a 30-day ceasefire in Ukraine before responding, while U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio hoped a deal would be struck within days. As Moscow considered the plan, President Vladimir Putin, dressed in military fatigues, made a surprise visit to Russia's Kursk region for the first time since Ukrainian troops captured part of it last year. With Putin's presence highlighting recent Russian advances in Kursk, Valery Gerasimov, head of Russia's general staff, told the Kremlin leader his troops had repelled Ukrainian forces from 86% of the ground they once held in Kursk. Ukraine had hoped to use that territory as a bargaining chip in any peace talks with Moscow. The U.S. on Tuesday agreed to resume weapons supplies and intelligence sharing with Ukraine after Kyiv said at talks in Saudi Arabia that it was ready to support a ceasefire proposal. The Kremlin on Wednesday said it was carefully studying the results of that meeting and awaited details from the U.S. Rubio said the United States was hoping for a positive response and that if the answer was no, then it would tell Washington a lot about the Kremlin's true intentions. Speaking to reporters when his plane refueled in Ireland, Rubio said on Wednesday, "Here's what we'd like the world to look like in a few days. Neither side is shooting at each other, not rockets, not missiles, not bullets, nothing. And the talking starts." Two people familiar with the matter said Russia has presented Washington with a list of demands for a deal to end the Ukraine war and reset relations with the United States. The specific demands were not clear, nor whether Russia, which holds just under a fifth of Ukraine, was willing to enter peace talks with Kyiv prior to their acceptance. The people said the demands were similar to previous Kremlin terms, including no NATO membership for Kyiv, recognition of Russia's claim to Crimea and four Ukrainian provinces, and an agreement that foreign troops not be deployed in Ukraine. Rubio said that Europe would have to be involved in any security guarantee for Ukraine, and that the sanctions Europe has imposed would also be on the table. After a meeting of five European defense ministers, British Defense Minister John Healey on Wednesday told reporters that work was accelerating on a coalition of the willing from Europe and beyond to support Ukraine. French Defense Minister Sébastien Lecornu said about 15 countries had expressed interest. In Kyiv, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky hailed this week's meeting in Saudi Arabia as constructive and said a potential 30-day ceasefire with Russia could be used to draft a broader peace deal. After Russian forces made gains in Ukraine in 2024, Trump reversed U.S. policy on the war, launching bilateral talks with Moscow and suspending military assistance to Ukraine, demanding that it take steps to end the conflict. Tuesday's agreement signaled a major improvement in U.S.-Ukraine relations after a clash between Trump and Zelensky at the White House last month sent them to a new low, but it did not alter the issues underlying the conflict with Russia, Ukrainian sources said. Russia's invasion of Ukraine in early 2022 has left hundreds of thousands of dead and injured, displaced millions of people, reduced towns to rubble, and triggered the biggest confrontation between Moscow and the West in six decades. During Putin's visit to Kursk, Gerasimov told him Russian forces had regained 425 square miles of territory. Kyiv's forces have been on the verge of losing their foothold in Kursk. Their main supply lines were cut, and they ceded control of the town of Sudzha. Putin called for Russia's forces to swiftly retake any remaining area from Kyiv's troops. He also made it clear he was considering the creation of a buffer zone in Ukraine's Sumy region across the border from Kursk. Deep state, an authoritative Ukrainian site that charts the front lines of the war, updated its battle map to show Ukrainian forces were no longer in control of Sudzha. However, it said fighting was continuing on the outskirts. Ukraine's top army commander said on Wednesday that Kyiv's troops will keep operating in Kursk region as long as needed, and that fighting continued in and around Sudzha. Putin has repeatedly said he is ready to talk about an end to the war, and Trump says he thinks Putin is serious, although other Western leaders disagree. Reuters reported in November that Putin was ready to negotiate a deal with Trump, but would refuse to make major territorial concessions and would insist Kyiv abandon ambitions to join NATO. Ukraine says the regions claimed by Moscow have been annexed illegally and that it will never recognize Russian sovereignty over them. Konstantin Kosachev, chairman of the International Affairs Committee of the Federation Council, the upper house of Russia's parliament, said on Telegram that Russia's advances in Ukraine must be taken into account in any deal. Real agreements are still being written here at the front, which they should understand in Washington too, he said. You're listening to Hour One of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Jack Palmer, and we'll continue with an article entitled Trump Moves to Unwind Over 24 Air and Water Regulations. The Trump administration announced a wave of regulatory rollbacks on Wednesday, including a repeal of Biden-era emissions limits on power plants and automobiles, as well as reduced protections for waterways. The announcement from Trump's Environmental Protection Agency aligns with the president's vows to slash regulations to boost industries from coal to manufacturing and ramp up oil and minerals production. But they are also destined to weaken bedrock environmental rules imposed by past presidencies to protect air and water quality and fight climate change. Today is the most consequential day of deregulation in American history, EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin said in a video message posted on X. In total, his agency announced more than 30 deregulatory measures in a dizzying succession of press releases. Zeldin started the day by announcing he will narrow the definition of waterways that receive protection under the Clean Water Act, a move that could ease limits on runoff pollution from agriculture, mining, and petrochemicals. The agency later said it would review the Biden-era Clean Power Plant rule that seeks to reduce carbon emissions from power plants to fight global warming, and would also roll back greenhouse gas emission standards for heavy and light-duty vehicles for model year 2027 and later. The power and transport industries together make up around half of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions and were vital targets in former President Joe Biden's efforts to slow climate change. The agency also said it would take steps to undo a scientific finding from 2009 that greenhouse gas emissions endanger public health, a provision that forms the bedrock of the EPA's greenhouse gas regulations so far. The so-called endangerment finding came as a result of a Supreme Court ruling in the 2007 Massachusetts versus EPA case that greenhouse gases are covered by the Clean Air Act. The EPA, under former President Barack Obama, finalized the finding in 2009, and the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act, Joe Biden's signature climate law, codified language deeming greenhouse gases as air pollutants. Obama's EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy said Wednesday was the most disastrous day in EPA history. Environmental groups said they will fight the rollback. "This move won't stand up in court. We're going to fight it every step of the way," said Jason Rylander, legal director at the Center for Biological Diversity's Climate Law Institute. Other environmental groups slammed Trump's broader deregulation agenda. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin is driving a dagger straight into the heart of public health, said Abel Russ, a director of the Environmental Integrity Project. Industry groups expressed support for the announcements. "Voters sent a clear message in support of affordable, reliable, and secure American energy, and the Trump administration is answering the call," said Mike Summers, president of the American Petroleum Association. The National Mining Association, which represents some coal miners, applauded the rollback of the Clean Power Plant rule, saying it was long overdue as data centers and AI increased electricity demand. The Trump administration plans to roll back other air and water regulations that have been in place for decades for the power industry. The EPA, for example, said it will reconsider mercury and air toxics rules that had been updated under Biden that it says were designed to target coal-fired power plants. The EPA also announced measures that would dial back regulations for the oil and gas industry. The next article is entitled, "Hamas Official Welcomes Trump's Apparent Retreat on Call to Replace Gazans." Hamas spokesperson Hazem Qassam welcomed on Wednesday President Donald Trump's apparent retreat from his proposal for a permanent displacement of Palestinians from Gaza, urging him to refrain from aligning with the vision of the extreme Zionist right. The statement by the Hamas official came after Trump said on Wednesday that nobody is expelling any Palestinians from Gaza, in response to a question during a meeting in the White House with Irish Prime Minister Michael Martin. "If U.S. President Trump's statements represent a retreat from any idea of displacing the people of the Gaza Strip, they are welcomed," Qassam said in a statement. "Hamas calls for this position to be reinforced by obligating the Israeli occupation to implement all the terms of the ceasefire agreements." Last month, Trump proposed a U.S. takeover of Gaza, where Israel's military assault in the last 17 months has killed tens of thousands, after he earlier suggested that Palestinians in the enclave should be permanently displaced. On Sunday, Taher El-Nono, political advisor to the leader of Hamas, confirmed unprecedented direct talks with Washington at the Qatari capital over the past week, focusing on the release of an American-Israeli dual national being held by the militant group in Gaza. He added that the meeting between Hamas leaders and U.S. hostage advisor Adam Bueller had also discussed how to see through the implementation of the phased agreement aimed at ending the Israel-Gaza war. Israel and Hamas signaled on Saturday they were preparing for the next phase of ceasefire negotiations, as mediators pressed ahead with talks to expand a 42-day truce that began in January. A Hamas delegation met in the past 2 days with Egyptian mediators and reaffirmed its readiness to negotiate the next phase of the ceasefire. Israel sent negotiators to Doha on Monday for ceasefire talks. The discussions between Bueller and Hamas have broken with a decades-old policy by Washington against negotiating with groups that the U.S. brands as terrorist organizations. The Islamist militant group carried out a cross-border raid into southern Israel on October 7, 2023, triggering a devastating war in the Gaza Strip that has killed more than 48,000 Palestinians, according to Gaza health officials. Hamas militants killed 1,200 people and took 251 hostages, according to Israeli tallies. If you miss any of these articles, you can always listen on demand by going to our website, sunsounds.org, click on broadcast info and audio, and then on demand. We'll continue with an article entitled "Judge Extends Ban on Students' Deportation." A judge on Wednesday extended his order blocking federal authorities from deporting a detained Columbia University student. U.S. District Judge Jesse Furman had temporarily blocked Muhammad Khalil's deportation earlier this week and extended the prohibition on Wednesday in a written order following a hearing in Manhattan federal court to allow himself more time to consider whether the arrest was unconstitutional. The Department of Homeland Security says Khalil, 30 years old, is subject to deportation under a legal provision holding that migrants whose presence in the country are deemed by the U.S. Secretary of State to be incompatible with foreign policy may be removed, according to a document seen by Reuters. The Secretary of State has determined that your presence or activities in the United States would have serious adverse foreign policy consequences for the United States, read the DHS document dated March 9th, ordering Khalil to appear before an immigration judge on March 27th. The document did not provide additional detail. The DHS did not immediately respond to requests for comments. Khalil's lawyers say his arrest on Saturday by DHS agents outside his university residence in Manhattan was in retaliation for his outspoken advocacy against Israel's military assault on Gaza following militant group Hamas's October 2023 attack, and thus violated Khalil's right to free speech under the U.S. Constitution's First Amendment. Mr. Khalil was identified, targeted, detained, and is being processed for deportation on account of his advocacy for Palestinian rights, Khalil's lawyer Ramzi Qasem said in court. Outside the courthouse on Wednesday, Qasem told reporters that the legal provision DHS referred to was rarely used and was not meant to silence dissent. Khalil, who is of Palestinian origin, came to the U.S. on a student visa in 2022 and became a permanent resident last year. He was a prominent member of Colombia's protest movement against Israel's military assault on Gaza. President Donald Trump has said on social media that Khalil supported Hamas, but his administration has not charged him with a crime and has not provided evidence to show Khalil's alleged support for the militant group. The Trump administration says pro-Palestinian protests on college campuses, including Columbia, have included support for Hamas and anti-Semitic harassment of Jewish students. Student protest organizers say criticism of Israel is being wrongly conflated with anti-Semitism. "This is not about free speech," Secretary of State Marco Rubio told reporters earlier on Wednesday during his trip to Ireland. "Being a supporter of Hamas and coming into our universities and turning them upside down, if you told us that's what you intended to do when you came to America, we would have never let you in." The case could ultimately test where immigration courts draw the line between protected free speech and alleged support for groups the United States calls terrorists. Hundreds of protesters gathered outside the courthouse in Lower Manhattan, holding signs reading, "Release Mahmoud Khalil," and chanting, "Down, down with deportation, up, up with liberation." At the hearing, Brandon Waterman, a lawyer for the government, said Khalil's challenge to his arrest should be moved to New Jersey, where he was held when his lawyers first sought his release, or Louisiana, where he is currently being held. Furman also ordered that Khalil be allowed 2 hour-long private phone calls with his lawyers, one on Wednesday and one on Thursday, after Qasem said Khalil's sole phone call with a member of his legal team from detention in Louisiana so far was cut off prematurely and was on a line recorded and monitored by the government. After the hearing, one of Khalil's lawyers, Sheza Abushi Dalel, read a statement from Khalil's wife, a U.S. citizen who is 8 months pregnant and did not wish to be named. "So many who know and love Mahmoud have come together, refusing to stay silent," the statement read. Even before Furman blocked it, there was no indication Khalil's deportation was imminent. Khalil has the right to plead his case to avoid deportation before a separate judge in immigration court, a potentially lengthy process. The next article is entitled, "Senate Democrats Fume Over Stopgap Bill." Senate Democrats huddled for hours on Wednesday, plotting a course forward on a stopgap funding bill passed by the Republican-controlled House, with only 2 more days remaining before a partial government shutdown would be triggered. In a gambit that is unlikely to succeed, Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of New York called for a 1-month extension of existing spending with the aim of providing time to complete more comprehensive appropriation bills for this year. Schumer warned that his caucus of 47 senators is unified in opposing the funding bill passed by the House, with only one Democrat there voting in favor of it. Blocking the bill would require at least 41 of Schumer's Democrats to vote against limiting debate on it, which could stop the measure dead in its tracks and could lead to a partial shutdown, which Democrats have long opposed as needless chaos. Their wariness of a shutdown comes amid Trump's rapid-fire campaign to unilaterally shutter many federal operations, which Democrats note is already causing disruption. "I hope our Republican colleagues will join us to avoid a shutdown on Friday," Schumer said in a short speech to the Senate. Republicans moved to place the blame squarely on Democrats. "If they decide to shut down the government, it's 100% a Schumer shutdown at that point," Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen told Reuters. The bill would achieve some reductions in non-defense programs and beef up military spending while handing Trump more say over how the money is spent. Democrats are seeking votes that could highlight spending cuts that many of their voters oppose. Americans are broadly supportive of the idea of cutting the size of the federal government, with 59% of respondents in a Reuters Ipsos poll completed on Wednesday saying they supported that goal. But they expressed concern about the way Trump was going about doing so, with a similar 59% saying they opposed the moves to fire tens of thousands of federal workers. Senator John Fetterman, a Pennsylvania Democrat who did not attend his party's midday meeting, downplayed options for his party. I'm not sure how realistic you're going to have any other choices than the one that's in front of us, Fetterman told reporters, referring to the House-passed funding bill. Fetterman criticized elements of the House-passed bill, such as a nearly $1 billion cut to the District of Columbia's budget, which Democrats argued is financed with city residents' and businesses' tax payments. Nevertheless, Fetterman said he is willing to vote for the House-passed bill, adding, I will never vote for chaos, and even more chaos than we are already in right now by forcing a government shutdown. Congressional brinksmanship, including repeated near misses with shutdowns and over the nation's $36 trillion in debt, has contributed to global ratings agencies' moves to downgrade the U.S. federal government's once pristine credit rating. The next article is entitled, Judge Questions Clawback of $20 Billion Climate Fund. A judge on Wednesday pressed President Donald Trump's administration for evidence of fraud, waste, and abuse in a $20 billion climate funding program that the administration has moved to terminate. U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan said she would order the administration to file a sworn statement by Monday detailing the evidence used to justify ending the grant, which aimed to fund greenhouse gas reduction projects. You can't even tell me what the evidence of malfeasance is, Chutkan said to a lawyer for the Trump administration during a hearing in U.S. District Court in Washington. Climate advocates and Democrats say the move illegally seizes money allocated for clean energy and transportation for disadvantaged communities. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lee Zeldin had publicized his campaign to claw back money from the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, which Congress appropriated under the Biden administration to kickstart projects aimed at curbing pollution. In a statement late on Tuesday, the EPA said it had clawed back the funds, saying the program did not align with the agency's priorities, citing concerns with potential fraud, waste, and abuse, although it gave no details or evidence for the allegations. Chutkan's demand for evidence came as part of a lawsuit brought by the Climate United Fund Advocacy Group, which sued the EPA and Citicorp's Citibank for withholding the funds. The group is seeking an emergency order temporarily requiring Citibank to disperse funds at its request, warning that it will run out of money as soon as Friday. A lawyer for the Trump administration argued the court no longer had jurisdiction over the dispute because the grant had already been terminated. The move is the latest development in the EPA's effort to take back funding that the Biden administration distributed last year to 8 organizations that were chosen to administer grants from the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund from an account held by Citibank, which holds a federal agency agreement with the Treasury. Zeldin has said the FBI and Justice Department are also investigating. The use of the FBI to investigate the funds has raised concerns with Democratic lawmakers who said the agencies have no grounds to probe Citibank or the grant recipients. The funding process followed a centuries-old framework that is set out transparently in a contract with Citibank and the Department of the Treasury and was announced publicly in April 2024, Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse said in a letter to Attorney General Pam Bondi and FBI Director Kash Patel. Whitehouse, who is the top Democrat on the Senate Environment Committee and on the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee, said the officials did not have a true basis to interfere with these properly appropriated and obligated funds. The EPA said it would work to use the funds with enhanced controls within the law, but did not say specifically what it would do with the money. EPA will be an exceptional steward of taxpayer dollars, dedicated to our core mission of protecting human health and the environment, not a frivolous spender in the name of climate equity, Zeldin said. Congress appropriated the $20 billion through the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act under Democratic President Joe Biden. Under Trump, the EPA has sought to freeze funding related to climate change and environmental justice amid legal challenges. Separately, the EPA announced in an internal memo on Tuesday that it will shutter the agency's Office of Environmental Justice and Civil Rights, which focuses on minority and low-income communities that have been hit hard by air and water pollution, along with its 10 regional offices as part of a broader reorganization of the agency. The EPA had put staffers in that office on administrative leave last month. It needlessly endangers the health of our children, particularly in areas overburdened by pollution, said Stephanie Reese, a director of the Moms Clean Air Force Environmental Group. And that's all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Jack Palmer. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.